Want more stories in your life without adding to your TBR? That's where Audible comes in. I use it for the original novellas, the Plus catalog like Deanna Reborn's Veronica Speedwell series, and those audiobook sales that you can beat. Right now, Audible has a special offer for new and returning members. Click the link in the show notes to see what deal you'll get and start listening today. Welcome to the Retro Next podcast. In this podcast, your host, Lori Amin, will interview published authors to chat about their work, journey to getting published, and their book recommendations. If you share a passion for books and always looking for your next read, then join us. Welcome to the Retro Next podcast. Today's guest is historical fiction author Elise Hooper. In this interview, we chat about what it's like to write historical fiction novels, her latest book, Fast Girls, and of course, a round of book recommendations. Now let's go to an interview. Hi, Elise. Welcome to the Retro Next podcast.
Hi, how are you? Thanks so much for having me.
So happy to have you here. Just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I live in Seattle. I live with my husband and my two daughters, one who's 14, one who's 11, and our rescue dog, Ramona the Pest.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. That is so cute. So what inspired you to become a writer?
You know, I mean, I feel like I was always writing. I don't know when I finally started thinking of myself as a writer, you know, in quotes there. But I had always been writing. And I mean, honestly, this ties back to my first book, The Other Alcott. I wrote a book about the Alcott sisters because I grew up as a neighbor almost to the Alcotts. I grew up in a town next door to Concord, Massachusetts. And I visited Orchard House, the Alcott family home that's now a museum, many times as a girl. And honestly, that's where I have kind of the clearest memory of walking into Louisa's bedroom and seeing that little desk where she wrote Little Women. And I mean, this sounds so basic, but I remember thinking, whoa, people write books. They don't just appear on your bookshelf. And I really remember feeling then that that would be a cool thing to do. Mm. And I think it's taken me a few decades to get to where I could really embrace feeling like that is, you know, what I felt comfortable doing, because for a while I worked in journalism, New England Cable News, and then for E! Entertainment Television. And then I was teaching English and history for a while. So I've been sort of circling this world of writing for many, many years. Mm. And I think, honestly, in some ways I came to it first as a reader because I did love books, and then really started thinking about writing my own books. But honestly, for a long time, I told myself I would try writing my first novel when life settled down a little bit, which, I mean, ha ha ha, now we know life never really settles down. And so it finally got to a point in my life where I thought, okay, I just need to go for this. What am I waiting around for? A book isn't going to write itself. And so when my youngest daughter headed off to kindergarten, I had this idea about the Alcott sisters and wanting to write a book about them. And I remember walking home from dropping my younger one off for that first day and sitting down in my living room in front of the stack of library books and thinking, very naively, I should add at the time, like, ha-ha, today is when I write my first book. And little did I know it would take me 5 years.
Oh, my gosh. So talk to me about that journey to get that first book published.
Right. Well, for several years, I was sitting at my dining room table in front of a laptop, reading and writing and reading and writing and writing and writing and doing a lot of deleting during that period and rewriting. And finally I got to a point where I had this Word document. I mean, I was spending hours every day working on this manuscript. And it's so crazy to me now to look back and think of that time when I was just spending so much time and effort, and I had two young kids, working on this story that I had no idea what would happen to it. And eventually I did go to a writing workshop with some agents, and they heard the idea, and all of them really encouraged me to finish. And that was a real turning point for me, because up till that point, I had been taking some writing classes and had some writing kind of circles, but really hadn't had someone tell me, yes, finish this. This could be something. Mm-hmm. And when I hit that point, then it was really, I kind of spent the next 6 months really with my nose to the grindstone, waking up at 5:30 in the morning to write and finish this. And I queried, I think, a few agents just to kind of test the waters, and I had a really positive response. And within a month of that first sending out those queries, I had signed with my agent. And yeah, and she was the one who said, okay, the Alcotts, I mean, that people are interested in this family, I can sell this. And she did. We had a very quick offer come in from William Morrow, HarperCollins, and you know, 3 books later, my Fast Girls is coming out with my same editor, same publisher, and everything. So it's been a very happy home for me.
Oh, that's so fantastic to hear.
Yeah, I feel very, very lucky.
That feels really lucky, and that's like a great imprint that did all this like amazing stuff. So.
Yes.
On a home. That's amazing.
Yeah, they love historical fiction. It is a great place to be.
Yeah. So let's talk about writing historical fiction. How much is research? How much is your creative freedom of fiction? You know, how do you combine both areas?
Right. Well, you know, that was actually something I really had to figure out with writing The Other Alcott again, because I started off thinking that book was going to be about Louisa, and I, you know, several months into it, realized that she actually wasn't my main character because so much is known about her. Mm-hmm. And I wanted someone who was a little more in the shadows. That book is a fun one because there are so many titles in historical fiction right now about women who have been overlooked in history, whose husbands or fathers or brothers, lovers, whatever, are the ones who have eclipsed them. And in the case of the Alcott sisters, it's May Alcott being overlooked by history because of her much more famous sister. So I do love that that story is about a woman eclipsed by a more famous woman. Mm. But so I do try to look for women who are just kind of footnotes in history books, who everyone's kind of overlooked. And Dorothea Lange may not fall into that category so much because she's very well known within the photography world. Mm-hmm. And everyone knows her famous photo, Migrant Mother. I mean, that has been a postage stamp. It's probably in every American history high school textbook in the country. But very few people kind of outside of photography really know of Dorothea's name and her work. And mm-hmm. And so she was someone who, while her life was well documented through her photos, and there have been some wonderful biographies written on her, she didn't keep extensive diaries or letters. So I had room to imagine who that woman was. And with these women of Fast Girls, my early pioneering Olympians, there was not very much about them at all. Mm. So this book I really feel is the first one where these women are the least known of anyone I've worked with so far.
Mm. And so let's talk about Fast Girl and the research. Where did you go? How did you get
started? How did I find this?
Yeah.
Well, it's a funny story, really. My younger daughter at the time was in fourth grade working on a biography project.
Okay.
And she is a swimmer. She swims year-round, is on swim team, and she had picked Gertrude Ederle for her biography project.
Okay.
Do you know who Gertrude Ederle is?
Yeah. Or what?
Neither did I. She was the first woman to swim the English Channel.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she was an American from New York, and she was an Olympian. And as I was helping my daughter, I was so struck by this world of early women athletes, because so often what is happening in the world of athletics mirrors what is happening in society, sort of a larger scale. Yeah. And so the early 1900s are filled with these women who were trying to make advances in sports, and their struggles show of what was happening in so many other aspects of American life. And so I started digging around because I have been a lifelong athlete. I still play competitive league tennis. Mm. I run marathons. I've done it all. So I was very interested in this subject, and and started doing some research. And I think the first one I found was Betty Robinson, who is the first woman. She was one of the first women on the Olympic team in 1928, which was the first year that the Olympics allowed women to run track and field.
Yeah.
And she, lo and behold, this kind of underdog of an American schoolgirl from Chicago at 16 years old, wins a gold medal in Amsterdam that year. Mm-hmm. And she is this real golden girl. She comes home, she is feted by Chicago and really the country at large. She was one of the few bright spots, actually, in the 1928 Olympics that had, I think, officials decided hadn't been the by any stretch, the most successful Olympics for the U.S. at that point. We had had a great, if you will, track record up until that point. And 1928 was a bit of a tough year for the U.S. But Betty was a bright spot. She won a gold in the individual 100 and a silver in the relay with three of her American teammates. And she comes home and is celebrated and finishes up high school and has her eye on 1932 Olympics and is ready to defend her title. And she is in a plane crash and was mistaken for dead, actually. And at the funeral home, they realized she was alive. And she has this amazing story of recovery and against all odds and against what the doctors tell her, she reappears for 1936, those Olympics. And so, I mean, right then and there, her story alone, I couldn't believe I had never heard of this woman. I mean, it is such a remarkable story. And I kept looking around, and then I found Helen Stevens, and she is really one of the most phenomenal women athletes in our history. And yet, you know, not many people know her name at all. She's really been lost to history. And then I found these women who were the first African-American women to qualify for the U.S. Olympic team. And their names, too, have been very much lost to history. None of these women, none of the four I've mentioned, are in the Olympic Hall of Fame. And so I really felt like these women needed to have their stories told. We need to know more about the women who really forged the way for these athletes we celebrate so much today, like Allyson Felix, and, you know, I'm not just thinking of track and field here, but also Simone Biles and Serena Williams, and mm-hmm. and so many of these early women helped pave the way for what we now see as American women athletes really dominate the sporting scene in so many ways.
I love it. I actually really felt that it was a story that I did not know. And it was like engaging for me just to learn about track and field, learn about the discrimination, the challenges that these women face just to be in the team.
Yes.
To run, you know, just for a simple thing of running.
Yeah. I know you think of that as being such a sort of an elementary thing. And certainly, you know, now it's such a marquee Olympic event. It's remarkable to think that, so the first modern games were in 1896, that between 1896 and 1928, women were shut out of the Olympics officially in track and field.
Yeah. And then even when they were in track and field, they were like, it's too strenuous. We can't have it.
I know. I mean, I really, the fact that the women's marathon wasn't added until 1984, and boy, as a young girl, I remember watching Joan Benoit run into the Coliseum in LA and win that first gold medal in the marathon, and yet I don't think I ever really pieced it together until I was writing this book that that was the first time women ran the marathon in the Olympics, officially. So yeah, the 800 wasn't added until 1860. All these longer races were held away from women because they were seen as too strenuous, and women looked tired the first time they ran the 800 in 1928, which, I mean, men looked tired too, but people were less concerned about that. And so yeah, women were held off in many ways from really showing all that they could accomplish. Yeah. And to be clear, even today, assuming the Olympics occur in July and in Tokyo, women still won't have equal number of events open to them that men will have open to them.
Really?
That's yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. I think Rio marks the high in women's participation. It's been steadily growing since 1960. Okay. but it's still about 45% of overall Olympians are women.
That's crazy.
You know, I know, because American women have really been dominating too.
Yeah, when I think about Olympics, I think about gymnastics, I think about swimming, I think about even track and field, I think about, you know, women runners and women swimmers.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes,
sir. So it's interesting that it's still not on par.
I know. I could not agree with you more. But, you know, I mean, even when you look at the leadership, the IOC is comprised still mostly of men. They have progress to make probably in every direction, really.
Yeah. Now, let's talk about race, because that's something you bring up, you know, the role of African-American athletes just joining a team and being discriminated. And then, you know, just being told you're not part of it. You're not, you don't belong here.
Right.
And how they have paved the way for African-American athletes who are dominating the field right now.
Absolutely. You know, it was, so Tidy and Louise first qualified in 1932 for the Games in Los Angeles. And it's never that they're told outright that we don't want you because you're Black, but it was a lot of cues that essentially culminate in the fact that they are pretty much passed over at the last minute. And as I dug around in all of the research, their times, everything you look at, they should have definitely been contenders. And I really think when you look at the sort of picture as a whole, and especially in 1932, they kept adding women who hadn't qualified in the trials to this relay pool. I really think it was never overtly told to Louise and Tidy that they weren't allowed to race because of their race, but that is what happened. Yeah. They had the sort of added, on top of being a woman, they were also a woman of color. And ultimately, that became a very difficult road for them to move ahead on in 1932.
Yeah, and it felt for Louise the most, because Tidy got a chance to compete. I know. But Louise, and I remember that scene of Louise telling Tidy, but you competed. Like, you actually were able to be, even though it wasn't the outcome you wanted, you're still worth able to show up. You know, I didn't get that opportunity. And that, you know, just getting so close to the opportunity and be like, you're not there yet.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, it is interesting. I mean, there were a few other women who, especially in 1936, went to the Olympics as qualifiers for the relay and didn't get to race. So there were several women who were passed over, but there was a consistent thing happening with Louise and Tidy. And when we look overall at the tenor of given in the direction of athletes of color in 1936, there was a lot of pressure on them. Mm-hmm. That the women had that sort of added strike against them that prevented them from being allowed to fully participate.
Yeah. So let's talk about the 1936 Olympics, because there's conversations about boycott, there's a Nazi regime, it takes in. You know, there's a lot of tension of what we know now would happen with the Nazi regime, which, you know, it's like building that tension around. Like, what kind of research did you conduct to get this part sort of right? You know, get the sense of, you know, Olympics were, this is a pivotal moment in the Olympics history. And then the U.S. and then, you know, Germany and all the, you know, World War II spring, you know, a few years later. So.
Right. Well, I read so much about, I mean, these Olympics to me are fascinating. And many readers will probably be familiar with them already from the story about Louis Zamperini in Unbroken or The Boys in the Boat. The 1936 Olympics really, first of all, they do set the tone for all modern Olympics to come. Many of the things we now associate with the Olympics, like the torch run or the torch relay rather, and some of the pageantry with the Olympics, that actually all dates back to 1936. Because Hitler he was actually very upset when he learned that Berlin had agreed to host those Olympics. But quickly his advisors kind of wised him up to the fact that it could be a huge propaganda win for him.
Mm.
So he turned it around, and I mean, he ends up using Leni Riefenstahl to create one of her very famous films about the games, and he sort of welcomes basically the world to come and see Berlin in all of its sort of pageantry, and he puts for sure the country's best foot forward. And so while many people are aware of the dark clouds that are hovering over Germany, at the same time Hitler put on a great show, and more than anything, he really wowed his own countrymen even into following him. And so I read a ton of books about, and magazine articles, all kinds of things, about scholarly articles as well, about these Olympics. And you know, some historians really say, you know, all of the U.S. Diplomats in Berlin were advising Roosevelt not to send a team. Mm-hmm. But he persisted. He wanted to have the Olympics happen. He more than anything wanted still Germany to keep paying their war reparations. So he wanted to keep on good terms with Germany. Mm-hmm. And so there were a lot of politics involved in this. And historians have questioned now, if FDR hadn't okayed this, if the U.S. hadn't sent a team, a lot of other countries would have followed suit and not participated. And where would that have left Hitler in 1935, you know, and 6, if the world had started turning its back already on him and it had stopped kind of enabling his surge in power? And it's a pretty fascinating idea. So that was really interesting to me. And then there are all of these other people in the mix, all these athletes, athletes of color, Jewish athletes, who are all unsure of their status in this games. And like Jesse Owens, who's probably one of the most famous Olympians, especially from 1936, he initially is under a lot of pressure for the NAACP not to compete, not to kind of endorse these games. Mm-hmm. But he and a lot of, there were about 20 African-American athletes who end up qualifying for this Olympics, they all decide that not only do they need to go to show Hitler and the Nazis that they're very capable, you know, that they can be successful, but they needed to show their own country. Because, you know, many of these athletes couldn't compete in many places in the South at this point because of Jim Crow laws. So, and many Jewish athletes couldn't join any certain clubs and things like that. So we had our own limitations placed on these athletes in our own country. So many of them felt that not only were they needing to prove something to Hitler, but they needed to prove something to the rest of America too. Mm-hmm. And I just found that incredibly compelling. And it really adds a whole new level of tension to already the tension of a athletic competition.
Yeah, it was just like, I think I felt like I was in the Olympics. It's funny enough, like, I've been to Berlin, and I actually went to the Olympic Stadium.
Oh, great.
It was interesting just so to see, like, you know, to feel like, okay, my experience in Berlin, to see, you know, experience in 1936 in the Olympics, and, you know, the tension.
Yes.
You know, the politics that the athletes had to pay, you know, Helen having to go to that party and, you know, and meeting Hitler and, like, those encounters, like, you know, that added a new set of tension that was outside of just playing the games or just running for a goal.
Yes. A lot was at stake at these Olympics. I mean, not only did these athletes each have something personal on the line, but there was a lot of symbolism in these games. There were a number of very heated matchups between American teams and German teams. Often the German teams were considered the favorites. And so that sets up, just like we saw in Boys in the Boat, also a lot of competitive tension in Fast Girls.
I really love Fast Girls. So what's next for you? What's your next project, do you think?
Right. Well, I am working on a World War II story set in the Pacific. which I feel partly compelled to do as someone who lives on this coast, on the West Coast. That's a world, I think, that is often overlooked these days. Yeah. I mean, World War II never ceases to apparently fascinate everyone. But I think for the most part, a lot of the stories recently have been coming from Europe.
Yeah.
And there are some great ones in the Pacific. And so I am currently at early stages of working on a story that I think will surprise a lot of people.
That's amazing. Yeah, I just wrote a book about that mentions World War II and the role of the Philippines. And it was compelling because it was like, I did not know about the Philippine military infantry, the U.S. infantry that goes to the Philippines. And it was like, it was something, I studied World War II in college, but I did not know about that history. So
right.
About the Pacific, you know, the Pacific part of the World War II, because there's so much stuff, there's so much information out there, but there's not enough stories around it. A lot of the stories are based on the Holocaust or just France or Germany, and not enough on the other part.
Well, Laura, I feel like you and I then have a strange connection, because just 10 days ago I was in the Philippines researching the new book I'm working on. So stay tuned.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
Yeah, isn't that funny?
That's so funny. Oh my gosh, I can't wait. So now let's go to a round of book recommendations. This is an opportunity for you to share with our audience what they should read next. So what is your favorite genre?
Oh, well, I definitely, my favorite genre is historical fiction. I mean, I write the stories essentially that I want to read, for sure. And so I could spend all day talking just historical fiction alone. I have some historical fiction recommendations. I also have tried to branch out because there are other genres I enjoy too. So I don't know where you want me to start. If I should start with historical fiction or...
Let's start with historical fiction first, and then sprinkle around the other recommendations.
Sure. Well, you know, a book that I loved was Lily King's Euphoria. And it was out, I mean, it came out a few years ago. She actually has a brand new book that's just come out that I haven't yet had the opportunity to read. I don't think it's historical fiction, but Euphoria is a book that is inspired by Margaret Mead's, or at least a few chapters of Margaret Mead's life, the great anthropologist. And it's a fascinating book. I mean, just its first few sentences are potentially some of the most grabbing sentences, opening of a book I've ever read. It's a beautiful book. So that is always a recommendation that I give to people. I also loved Dawn Tripp's book, Georgia, about Georgia O'Keeffe. Gosh, I mean, my bookshelves are full of historical fiction, and I love them all.
I love it.
So, those are a few. I've loved, Robin Oliveira has some novels out that I love. My Name is Mary Sutter, which she actually, I think, was partly a little bit inspired by Louise May Alcott and her tenure as a Civil War nurse. My Name is Mary Sutter is about a woman who wants to become a doctor during the American Civil War. And it's a beautiful book. And her books are lovely. I mean, I really could spend all day talking historical fiction. I read, not only do I write a lot, but I read a lot.
Do you have a preference in terms of time period of historical fiction, or are you just open to?
Boy, that's a good question. You know, I really don't. I think I have probably been reading a lot of historical fiction in the last couple of years that is from the last 200 years.
Okay.
But no, and to be honest, I love to be surprised by books that are set in overseas. This winter had read Lisa See's newest book, set in Korea, about the, boy, is it Island of the Sea Women, I think is the title.
Okay.
I loved that book, and it was full of just fascinating, it was such a fascinating subject. I learned so much reading that one.
Well, that's awesome. And how about other genres? Any book that we should check out?
Sure. Well, I always have a book, sort of a paper, you know, hard copy book going. I also always have audiobooks going. And so I have a couple of audiobook recommendations that kind of span a few different genres. My first, and I think anyone who enjoys audiobooks has to listen to Trevor Noah's Born a Crime.
Yeah.
Have you read it or listened to it?
I haven't listened to it. It was fantastic.
Isn't it? I mean, his life story is so interesting. Mm-hmm. And his accent, of course, if you listen to it, he reads it. He's got this beautiful speaking voice. I mean, the book, it's just a phenomenal audiobook.
Yeah.
Okay. And yeah, and he's also, there's a young readers edition out that my kids have read and really enjoyed too. So that's one the whole family can enjoy. Of course, I loved Michelle Obama's audiobook of Becoming. It was, I read the regular book too. I love both. All versions are, I can't get enough of Michelle Obama. Yeah. I loved, She Said, I learned so much from that book, Megan Tuohy and Jodi Kantor, about the Harvey Weinstein, their investigative reporting surrounding that. It is a nail biter of a book all about journalism. It's fascinating.
I love it.
Yeah.
My TBR. So I think I may bump it up as my nonfiction book for the month. It's something I'm interested, especially with the Harvey Weinstein, trial and whatnot. It will be definitely interesting to see, how they broke the story.
Absolutely. It's a great, great book. I highly recommend it. I will also give a thriller. I feel like thrillers are so hot right now.
Yeah.
I fairly recently had finished Long Bright River, which was great. And set in Philadelphia. It's about a woman who's lost her sister, and this, our main character is a policewoman. It kind of kept me guessing right up to the end. It's a fascinating look at the opioid crisis. Mm-hmm. It's really, there's a lot of heart in that book. It's a lovely book. So heartbreaking, but very compelling.
I love it. So tell us where we can find you online.
Elise Hooper. I'm pretty much consistently Elise Hooper everywhere. I probably spend the most time on Instagram. I love looking at pictures. Yeah. So I do the most on Instagram. Facebook too. I'm on there as Elise Hooper. Twitter too, although probably my tweeting is the least consistent of my social media practices. But definitely Instagram. Not only do I sort of post stuff about books or just knitting or dogs or whatever I'm up to, but also I love to see what other bookstagrammers are reading and get recommendations. So I try to be pretty interactive there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like seeing what people are eating, all kinds of good stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of fun. So thank you so much for being the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so delighted that you enjoyed Fast Girls and enough to ask me to join you on your podcast. Thank you.
Thank you. If you enjoyed this podcast, feel free to share with friends, subscribe, or rate and review the show. This is the easiest way to support this podcast. Want to join a romance loving community? Want weekly book recommendations, monthly author Q&As, and book recommendation meetups? Make new friends? Then join our Patreon community. To sign up, please follow the links in the show notes. What to Read Next podcast is part of the Frolic Podcast Network. Find more podcasts to love on frolic.media/podcast. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.
Are you an author, publisher, or book-related business looking to reach passionate readers? What to Read Next podcast is a perfect place to connect with an engaged audience of romance and mystery lovers who are always on the hunt for their next great read. Now, we're offering sponsorship opportunities. Whether you're launching a new book, promoting an upcoming release, showcasing a bookish product or services, we can help you get the word out. Let's work together to bring your books or businesses to readers who are ready to discover something new. Please visit whatyoureadnextblog.com/sponsorships to learn more or reach out to chat about the perfect sponsorship or package for you. Thank you much for listening. Your next great reader is waiting for you.